Hello, and welcome to A History of Hannibal, Episode 31, Trouble in Paradise. Fabius and Rome had seemingly been happily married for a few months now. They were blissfully in love since that magical day when they got married. Love conquered all for them. They were completely unbearable around their friends. Syracuse, suited up of course, made being sick expressions behind their backs, much to Capua's amusement. They were quite happily willing to overlook the flaws in the other. But this wore off. The honeymoon couldn't last forever. When they were on a wild night out in Campania, Fabius got a bit too close with Hannibal for Rome's liking. They went back to their place and had a huge fight. Rome was furious with what had happened. Fabius screamed, "You knew I was like this when you married me!" Rome burst into tears and ran to Minucius. Things went a bit too far, and Rome had to deal with the situation the next morning. "Hey, wait a minute. This doesn't sound quite right. I may have got my notes mixed up a bit there. Let's try that again." Hello and welcome to A History of Hannibal, Episode 31, Trouble in Paradise. Thank you, people, for your feedback on last week's Let's Talk with Jordan Harbour. I'd like to think I'm improving at doing them. At the very least, I'm able to maintain a conversation for the first 5 minutes without resorting to.
So you're Rome history? You are Rome history?
I am Rome history. What a thing to say.
So I definitely consider that an improvement. The show definitely had a different feel to the first one, and hopefully I'll be able to use my newfound knowledge for the third one. Remember, in episode 35, we will discuss whether Hannibal should have marched on Rome. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject, and get to them in the show. So please send in your opinions. thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com. Now, on to the show. Where did we leave things 2 weeks ago? Hannibal had just escaped from Fabius in the middle of the night and had set up camp at Alifi. Fabius followed Hannibal to Alifi and then chased him around Campania for a while before he moved back into Apulia, while Fabius encamped near Larinum, the modern Larino in northern Apulia, slightly further north from Hannibal's base in Gerionium. Fabius was then forced to return to Rome to fulfil his religious duties. This meant that Minucius was left in charge. Fabius begged Minucius to continue following his strategy. He said if all they could accomplish this summer was to frustrate Hannibal, then that would be good enough. After all, sometimes the doctor prescribes his patients to rest rather than to exercise. Minucius ignored this advice. He almost immediately began planning an attack and moved south towards Hannibal's base at Gerionium. Aware that a new commander was in charge, Hannibal moved his camp to within 2 miles of the Roman camp, to within their sights, and sent out a third of his army to join his foragers. The aim of this was to let the Romans know that their foragers were protected. Hannibal would have no doubt preferred to have attacked as soon as he could, but his force was weakened due to the number of foragers he had, and Hannibal had to avoid battle until he was strong enough to act. Eventually, a battle took place. The Romans were initially successful, and the Carthaginians withdrew. But they turned, and with the arrival of the Numidians, severely shook the Romans. Things were looking bad, until the Samnite, Numerius Decimus, arrived with a force of 8,000 infantry and 500 horsemen, as reinforcements sent by Fabius. This was enough to turn the tide in favour of Rome. Fearing a trap, Hannibal withdrew. Roman losses stood at 5,000 deaths, while the Carthaginians had lost 6,000. The losses were heavy for both sides, but as the Carthaginians had lost slightly more men, events were reported as a great victory for Minucius. This did not help things for Fabius. Fabius was becoming really unpopular at Rome. Really unpopular. Hannibal took advantage of this, refusing to attack Fabius's land. Fabius's inaction that night in Campania, combined with this, made some suspect that perhaps Fabius was in league with Hannibal. This was made even worse through Fabius's gentlemanly conduct. You see, since the First Punic War, there had been an agreement between Rome and Carthage that they would exchange captured prisoners. Whichever side gave the more prisoners would pay 2.5 pounds of silver for each man. Fabius had paid this for the extra 247 Roman prisoners, but he had done this without consulting the Senate. This was highly unpopular. Fabius managed to save this particular PR crisis by selling the property which Hannibal had spared and using the money to pay off the public debt. But this action was too little, too late. When the report of Minucius's victory came in, everyone in Rome believed that this was proof of Rome's superiority in arms. Fabius had been far too cautious. He had acted very un-Romanly. The only person in Rome who didn't believe the reports was, well, Fabius. He even stated that if the report was true, he was more fearful of success than defeat. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. The tribune Metilius snapped. He declared that Fabius was solely concerned with prolonging the war to increase his own power. One of the consuls was dead. The other had been removed from Rome, supposedly to pursue a Carthaginian fleet. The two praetors were in Sardinia and Sicily, despite neither province needing one, while he had effectively put his master of horse under guard to prevent him from taking action. He was jealous and wanted all the glory, all the power. What were the results of this policy? Hannibal had been given as free rein in Samnium as they had previously allowed him south of the Ebro. Campania, Calernum, and Falernum had been ravaged, while Fabius used the resources of the state to protect his own private estates. Minucius was kept like a prisoner, simply for wanting an honest fight with an enemy on Roman soil. And the moment Fabius left, Minucius delivered a stunning victory. In Book 22, Chapter 25, Livy puts the following speech in Metilius's mouth as the conclusion to his plea. "And therefore, if only the people of Rome were like their fathers of old, I should have boldly proposed that Quintus Fabius should be deprived of his high office. But, as things are, I shall moderate my demand, asking only that power be equally shared between the dictator and the master of horse. To this, I add one further suggestion, that, even if my demand is accepted, Fabius shall not be sent to rejoin the army till he has seen to the election of a consul in place of Gaius Flaminius. Fabius avoided the assemblies, as he knew he would receive a hostile reception there. Even the Senate barely tolerated his praise of Hannibal and his attribution of the disastrous last 2 years to the rashness of Sempronius and Flaminius. The senators were bitterly hostile under the surface. He added that Minucius should be recalled to Rome and be punished for disobeying his orders. He says, also in Book 22, Chapter 25, "If the supreme command, with full direction of affairs, is entrusted to me, I shall soon make everyone realise that, to a good commander, the shifts of circumstance are never of the first importance. What counts is intelligence combined with a firm grasp of principle. That I saved the army without dishonour, before it was too late, is a better thing than the killing of many thousands of the enemy." This line of thought was not popular in the Senate. Not one bit. The consul Marcus Atilius Regulus was elected to the consulship, and to avoid debate on the distribution of command, Fabius returned to his army. Public opinion was overwhelmingly in favour of Minucius over Fabius. But a motion would need senior backing to move forward. Finally, a man was found who was willing to propose it. Gaius Terentius Varro. Yes, that Varro. Varro came from humble origins. His father was a butcher, and in his youth he was brought up in the same trade. When he inherited his father's savings, he began to hope for bigger things. He loved being in the forum, wearing a toga, and making speeches on behalf of the underdog and against the nobility. He served as a quaestor, twice as an aedile. Then he held the praetorship, and he was now hoping that he could take the consulship. He saw this as the perfect situation. He proposed that Minucius share dictatorial powers with Fabius. The motion was passed, and Varro received all the credit. This is a very interesting story. The way Livy tells it for a Roman audience makes Varro seem like a poor general. His low birth was a very negative quality in the eyes of Livy. Yet, when I've read it, the way the story reads to me, and the way I've told it, makes it seem quite optimistic. A man of low birth is able to save his family's fortune, and is determined to overcome these obstacles, and rise to the top of a career path he loved. It's something I admire, and Western society as a whole admires. We love an underdog. We love a story of an improbable rise to the top. It's admirable. Inspirational. While the masses definitely saw Varro in this manner, as they would later see Marius, the aristocracy, including Livy, and the audience he was rising for, will not have seen Varro in this way. He would be seen as a new man, a sign of trouble, a change to the status quo. This has much to do with Livy's harsh judgments of Varro, and as a result, Western historiography's harsh judgments of Varro. In recent years, there has been a tendency to reassess Varro, but this isn't something for now. We'll look at it later. Fabius received a letter with the news of Minucius' promotion while he was on his way to the army. He took the news calmly. He wasn't going to change his whole ideology for this. Minucius did not bear the news calmly. His ego exploded. He bragged that he had defeated Fabius, even more than he did of his victory over Hannibal. He considered that, as for the first time a junior officer had been made the equal of a dictator who had been called upon to save the Roman state. That, obviously, this was due to his own brilliance. He was determined to pursue his own path, just as Fabius was to pursue his. In short, they were both on a collision course, and we'll get into this next week. One final thought before we wrap up. This decision by the Senate effectively killed the office of the dictatorship. The point of the dictator was that decisive action could be taken by a single person, without interference from anyone. Having an equal in the office defeated the point of it, just as did the fact that the Senate could interfere with the office. It's quite a momentous moment in Roman constitutional history, and it would be improper to let the moment pass. If you've enjoyed listening to the show, why not find us in all the usual haunts online? thehistoryofpodcast.blogspot.com, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast, twitter.com/thehistoryofpod, youtube.com/thehistoryofpodcast, thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com, thehistoryofpodcast.spreadshirt.co.uk, as well as the History Podcasts Facebook group. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.